I'm Jordan Abel, Director of Public Programs at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco, and I welcome you to BINA, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the JCCSF. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. On this edition of BINA, our guest is writer of short stories, essays, novellas, and children's books, George Saunders. He's joined in conversation by author Dana Spiota. And now, join Stephanie Singer on stage at the JCCSF as she introduces George Saunders and Dana Spiota.
George Saunders is considered a master of the short story form, and now he's written his first novel. The author of 9 books, including The 10th of December, his often irreverent humorous work takes on big subjects like class, morality, and love, and it offers a glimpse of how we live today. He's long been admired as a writer's writer, with fans including Jonathan Franzen, Zadie Smith, Karen Russell, and the late David Foster Wallace. He's received MacArthur and Guggenheim Fellowships, the Penn Malamud Prize for Excellence in the Short Story, and was recently elected to the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. He teaches in the Creative Writing Program at Syracuse University. George Saunders is here this evening to share with us his long-awaited first novel, Lincoln in the Bardo, a moving and original father-son story featuring Abraham Lincoln, as well as an unforgettable cast of supporting characters, living and dead, historical and invented. Colson Whitehead, in his review for the New York Times, calls it, quote, a luminous feat of generosity and humanism. Appearing in conversation with George is the wonderful Dana Spiota, the award-winning author of Innocence and Others, Stone Arabia, and Eat the Document, among others. Ladies and gentlemen, let's welcome George Saunders to the stage.
Thank you very much. So basically about 22 years ago or something, when I was 4, my wife and I and our kids were in D.C., and we were driving past this graveyard, Oak Hill Cemetery, and my wife's cousin just kind of casually pointed up and said, that's the crypt where Lincoln's son was. And I'm like, I didn't know that Lincoln had a son, didn't know that he had died. And she said Lincoln had actually been so grief-stricken that he supposedly, according to the newspapers at the time, had gone into the crypt and held the body, which just kind of, blew my mind. And it stuck with me for about 20 years. And at the time, I kind of felt like, that's beautiful material, but I had a writing teacher once who said there are two kinds of stories, the kind you write and the kind you think about writing. And I was pretty sure it was in the second category. It seemed somehow too heartfelt and earnest, and I didn't think I could do it. So in 2012, I had just finished that 10th of December and had sent it off, and I kind of had a talk with myself, like, what would you like to do? And this little voice said, I'd like to do that Lincoln story. And I was like, nah, we're not doing that. That's too difficult. And then I thought, I don't want to be the guy who, like, on his own gravestone, it says, too scared to try the thing he most wanted to do. That probably would be... So I thought I would try, and I gave myself sort of like a 3-month contract before the book came out to just fart around with it and see if, anything would happen. So, I'm sure there's a lot of writers out there, and sometimes what happens is the material dictates the form right away. Sometimes from the first couple lines, there's a DNA, and part of the aesthetic of any work of fiction is that it's full of problems right from the beginning, full of difficulties. So for this one, I'm like, okay, so Lincoln goes into the graveyard. Who narrates that? It could be like a 300-page, third-person book in the head of Lincoln, which was a little scary, like 4 score and 7 minutes ago, I did come into this here graveyard. So then, I messed around for a while, and suddenly it became clear, who's in a graveyard at night? A dysfunctional gravedigger? No. So I thought ghosts, ghosts would be good. So the ghost ended up narrating most of the book. And then at some point, there were so many ghosts, and a ghost is kind of the ontological equivalent of a dream sequence. Like, a ghost can do anything, a ghost does a backflip, okay. So it started feeling like that needed a little bit of pushback. So what I did in the book is that I kind of threaded in some actual historical text to give it a little bit of spine. So basically, the book is, it all takes place in one night in a graveyard. It's filled and narrated by ghosts, and every so often I just would punctuate it with some sort of the spine of historical sources. Thank you so much for being here, and now we'll give you a little sample of Lincoln and the Bardo. Hi, Dana.
Hi, George. Congratulations.
Thank you. Thanks.
The first time I read this book, I read it so quickly, I couldn't stop reading it, and I was so moved. It's so deep and so beautiful. And then I read it again for this to prepare, and I was really struck, well, first of all, by how funny it is, which I was, you know, on the sentence level, the humor is amazing. But what I was really struck by was just the virtuosity of the construction, how intricate it is, and the audacity of your imagination. And I just thought, you know, they keep trying to kill the novel, and you know,
I did my part.
And you, and you've invented it again, and it is, you know, it's alive. It's inspiring. It makes me excited to write another novel because I'm thinking, look at all these possibilities. You take these huge risks, you know, and so we're going to talk about it all. We're going to talk about the heart, and we're going to talk about the technical. We're just going to go everywhere with it. So let's begin with Lincoln. We'll get to the Bardo later. You write about this. You're writing about this character who is a iconic American figure. There's a completely a received idea of Lincoln in everyone's head,
right.
And you not only do you write about him, but you also inhabit him in the most intimate way. So talk to me about that and how you did that.
Well, I think that was one. You know, at the beginning, I said I was avoiding this idea like the plague, and I think that was part of it. You know,
right.
The idea of now I'll do Abe Lincoln. Sure you will. You know. And I guess the danger is that you would read his speeches and do his speeches, which I don't think he was doing that level of rhetoric in his head.
Right,
So then I was sort of intimidating, and then I thought, you know, actually once I figured out it was in one night, then you could do that novelistic thing where you sort of say, all right, I'm not doing a book about Lincoln. I'm doing 18 minutes with Lincoln,
right,
in four intervals at certain physical places when he's just come from somewhere and is about to go somewhere else. So that eliminates a lot of the stress. You know, you don't have to make some overarching theory about him.
Right.
But you have to remember where he's sitting, like what hurts.
Right.
What, you know.
What constraints did you have, though? I mean, what were you willing to make up and what were you tethered to?
I kind of felt like, you know, in a way you're doing a mind meld, as you, with any fictional character, it's your stuff going into a mold.
Mm-hmm.
So the mold is maybe like the historicity, and in his case, we know that pretty well. So it was kind of like, started off by imagining his physicality, then, you know, like titrating in my ideas, but then they were always kind of caught and constrained by the mold.
Mm-hmm.
So if you had him suddenly doing something really weird, mm-hmm, or that was too much like me, then the mold would say, no, you can't do that. So it was kind of and for me, the whole way it works is voice.
Right.
Anyway, so a lot of it was trying to read a lot of his stuff, put it all in my head.
Letters, mostly?
Letters, speeches,
okay,
some reported speech. People, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Then I said, all right, I'm just going to trust that it's up here in this kind of hopper and then forget about it.
So just immerse yourself in it and then don't look at it while you're
writing.
Yeah,
and trust it in the moment of improv, you're primed.
Yeah.
And the thing you wanted to, you know, to avoid is like, he used this phrase one time. He said, we must disenthrall ourselves and we will save our country. I'm like, yeah, disenthrall. You know, so but then you try to work that in and you know, I must disenthrall myself and go home or something.
That's good, though.
You know, yeah, it's beautiful. It's
good,
beautiful.
Yeah.
So then it's interesting, you know, what's the difference between our polished public pronouncements,
right,
and this, you know, the stuff that's going on in there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you talked a little bit in the introduction about this form that you invented. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, the best innovations of form come out of necessity, right? So let's talk about like the problem you were solving, the historical fiction problem. Maybe it's a problem of exposition. What's the problem?
That's it. I shied away from it because I loved Gore Vidal's book, but whenever I try to write in that kind of authoritative third person, it just is a buzzkill. There's no power. So then the question was, how could I do an historical book that's, I guess, you know, it had to be in some kind of 19th century diction,
mm-hmm.
and just have it not stall out on the language level. So
right.
I think that's kind of where the ghost came in, just as a way of a responsibility to keep the language kind of jazzy. You could do that. So the ghosts, and actually, you know, it's funny, at this stage of a book, you're just starting to talk about it and articulate
yeah.
it, and I realize I actually don't know a lot of this stuff. Like,
mm-hmm.
I was thinking, how does this book start? And there's like four different creation narratives I can report
okay.
that are all true and
right.
simultaneous and a little contradictory, so I'm not quite sure.
So you,
but
so
I
you made
have,
a decision to have the ghosts tell most of the story.
Yeah, and the reason is because many years ago I had another novel with ghosts in it, right about the time that Chatlines got invented.
We never saw that novel.
No, you will never see that if you're lucky, unless you try to quit at Syracuse and I'll make you read it. But it was sort of when the Chatline first was invented, and I loved the way it looked. You know, you'd have
mm-hmm.
a George and then some garbled nonsense, and
yeah.
then Dana and some garbled stuff, and then you'd ask a question, and 8 pages later it would get
yeah,
answered.
Yeah.
You know, so I started a book just on that idea: a bunch of ghosts talking. But the only thing I didn't have there was any kind of through line. So that was kind of in my mind at the time.
Interesting.
Yeah, so you have ghosts. And then, as I said, you know, you start, it gives you so much license that I think a reader starts feeling a little bit like, okay.
Where's the net?
Yeah, where's the net? Exactly right. Yeah, and so that's where the, and then also the, I kept thinking, why is this story spoken to me all these years? And part of it was that over the years, I'd read enough history to get some of the side story.
Right.
So one of the things that happened, it was so heartbreaking, is that, Willie was sick, and his brother was sick, but you know, medium sick. The Lincolns had a party scheduled.
Tad.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
Tad. And they had a party scheduled, big deal, and all Washington watching. And then the boys got a little worse. And the parental decision was, do we cancel this or not?
Mm-hmm.
And a doctor said, no, I think it'll be okay. They have the big party, big, loud thing, and the boys get worse.
Mm.
And in Willie's case, you can plot it. That's when he started to die, was that night.
Mm-hmm.
So they struggled with it, and the culture kind of weighed in, what terrible parents they are. So I thought, well, how do you get that in?
Mm-hmm.
And so finally one day I thought, how do you know about it, dummy? You know,
mm-hmm.
like, well, I read it.
Mm-hmm.
And then some little light went on, like, oh, yeah, I could just sample these things, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I kind of thought I'd try it, and I just typed all of them up, two or three big swaths of different books, and cut them up with scissors and got on the floor and started rearranging them.
And so you've organized them so there's kind of the historical parts tell the narrative of Willie's death.
Right.
And so there's kind of like an arc that goes that way. And that all happens before the night in the Bardo. So we're
right.
kind of going through two timelines too. So you have this kind of interesting kind of momentum in both of them.
Yeah.
And it's sort of curated by subject. So we talk about the party, and we talk about the night he dies, and you talk about the funeral, and there's contradiction within that, which
right.
I thought was so interesting, like what color eyes Lincoln had, or whether the moon was out. So why did you put some of that you found,
yeah.
and then you added imaginary historical stuff
to
even complicate
yeah.
it further. So why did you do that?
Well, I knew I had to have the historical spine just to make the emotional pop that I wanted, and then I had a kind of rule like, You can't just drop one in there for no reason.
Right.
The idea is that Lincoln's sitting there, and he has a psychological moment of going, oh, you know, I would never kill a kid. And he goes,
Yeah.
You know. So that was like the allowance. At that point, I felt, okay, now you can do that. So one of the sort of constraints was you can't just, you have to be a little bit conservative with those historical things.
Right.
Which means it has to be triggered by a character's action.
Right. Okay. So that was your rule.
Yeah, that was kind
so
of
you
the,
invented a kind of constraint for yourself.
Right, like a
yeah.
controlling rule. And then the other thing I noticed was, okay, so that party, I had been thinking about it about 15 years since
mm-hmm.
I read this book by Margaret Leach. And when I just took the straight line history things and put them in there, it was a little flat relative
mm-hmm.
to the novelization in my mind.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought, I wonder if I'd be allowed to make up a couple factual
mm-hmm.
things, which it turns out you are.
And
so I did that, and then suddenly it was such a, I remember it so well because I've been doing this basically sampling or sort of like low-level plagiarizing, and I could just imagine myself, like, you're not writing, dude, you're just typing, you know, you're
mm-hmm.
just stealing, basically. And then one day I had this really cool thing where I had a version in the morning, and I read it, and then I just farted around with it all day, read the one at the end, and I was like, that's better. That's better. With the additions and with the arranging, it's better. So then I thought, all right, well, maybe curation is part of the
mm-hmm.
task, you know. So then it got really crazy because you could make things up. And then there was a phase where I was making up these really wonderful, funny things
right.
that stuck out like sore thumbs. So then the job becomes make them up a little less flashy.
Yeah, you really smuggled them in there. I went through the book and I looked. I had to look up to see which were imaginary and which weren't. I mean, some of them, one I knew was imaginary, the social life of the Civil War, frolic, carnage, and extirpation.
Yeah, that, I think that's
that was,
right, yeah.
I suspected that was not real. But there were, but it is very, I mean, you really get caught up in, some of the wildest ones are real, you know? And that reminded me of E.L. Doctorow when you're reading Ragtime, that some of the crazy stuff is the real historical stuff. Oh. And he puts the imaginary next to the historical, which you do so well. And what do you think that does when we write, or in Colson Whitehead's book, when you have, what does the imaginary do to the historical document?
Yeah.
And I think part of the thing is that the historical document itself is a subjective thing because we get different narratives, right?
Right.
So it's already kind of...
Exactly. What I thought with this book was you really, what's the novel do? It's supposed to tell a truth greater than banal regular truth. It's supposed to...
The
facts are fine, but at some point... The contract that we enter into together is I'm going to really try for 4 years to make something that will shoot out at the end a truth that neither one of us knew before. It's not reducible. That's the goal.
Right.
So then I think you get into it and you're like, well, by any means necessary, you know. So if you're telling
any possibility was on the table at that point.
I think so. I think it has to be because again, the it's not a catalog and it's not a historical book.
Right.
You know, a history
right.
book. So I'm trying to. Affect a feeling of emotional movement in the reader that is truer than true.
Right.
That's the end game. So it's almost like if you had you're telling a bunch of kids a ghost story. Well, first of all, you don't want to fail because they'll kill you, you know.
Right.
And then you might say, you know, a terrible thing happened in this very theater. You know, and like, whoa, really? And they might even know that it didn't happen in the theater, but the fact that you said, you see these curtains right here,
mm-hmm.
you know, then all of a sudden you're more engaged. So I think that's part of, you can use the historicity as one more tool to make the, you know, to make the thrill.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I think, you know, I think that's fair game in the novel. It's not fair game in the White House.
Right.
You know, that's different. Yeah. And I think actually, you know, I think I said this a little today on the radio, I think we have to be careful in the times to come that those of us who love art keep that boundary very strong. It's not the same. If a duck waddles into the White House and you say, look, a rhino, or, you know, that's not the same, you know. So I think that's part of the...
Your book is called Fiction.
And you come in to that room and we all know what it is.
Yes,
and,
absolutely. Yeah. There's huge. So let's... In your book, in all your work, there's a amazing combination of humor and emotion. Like, for example, in Victory Lap, it's the wit and the humor in that story, and then all of a sudden it comes up, and you're weeping at the end of it. And I always thought the humor kind of disarmed you, and then that would have let you feel something. But I feel now, reading this book, the humor is so tied in with the serious content. How do you think that works in your work?
Mm.
Do you always feel that both those things have to be there?
I actually think of it kind of crassly as, you know, you're riding a bike. And I know I have two tendencies. One is kind of a sentimental, I think of it as a working class kind of, everything's great sort of that, with a real darkness that I don't know where it comes from. So I think early in my career, I was trying to deny both of those because they both seemed a little gross, you know. But then I think maturity is to say, no, you know, for whatever reason, that's the way that I am. So can you combine them in a way that keeps the bike somewhat straight? So if you start to get too... emotional or, you know, but I think that also has a real life corollary, which is that the only reason we make the distinction between tragedy and comedy is because it's too scary to think of them as one thing.
Right.
You know?
Right.
So if we say, if life is a tragedy, then I kind of know how to manage that. I know how to manage tragedy. If life's just a farce, I know how to manage that. But God says, sorry, dummy, you didn't invent the world, I invented it.
It's
and
both.
Those are just your stupid categories.
Mm-hmm.
Watch, you're going to fart at a funeral, you know.
Yeah.
And you're still going to be sad.
And
still going to be a little bloated.
There's a lot of farting.
Yeah, there's a lot of farting.
A lot of farting in this book.
It's a good go-to. You
it's
know
a lot of farting. But I think that in this book, and more so than your stories, it feels more integrated almost.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like it's always all there all the time.
Yeah.
And it's not, and the humor, I always thought the humor kind of undercut the sentimentality, but I don't think so. I feel like and sentimentality is the wrong word, because it feels earned. It's emotional is the way, the word I would prefer, where you feel the humanness that is both tragic and farcical, right?
Well, you know, and in the writing, one of the things that I found happening was that because in the 19th century diction, a lot of that humor was destabilized a little bit,
yeah,
which is kind of, you know, a little jarring. And then also there was something about, with that diction, I found that what I would have called humor, ha-ha, funny, got a little bit repurposed into something that at the time it felt like, I was thinking wit or like awareness of where you are in the prose. So, for example, if things start getting a little too straight, I would just kind of remember, oh, yeah, that guy's got a huge penis, you know?
I can't forget the penis.
So, but that was a kind of a way of doing what any writer does, which is as you move onto page 44, part of the job is to remember exactly what you've put in motion.
Yeah.
Yeah. So now that's also humor. That's how a joke works.
Yes.
So I kind of felt as the, especially in the more serious scenes, that, okay, maybe it's not funny, but it's this other thing that's got the same family origin, which is some kind of textual awareness of what you've put into play and what then you can then pull down into the story, you know.
You're listening to writer George Saunders, whose new novel is Lincoln in the Bardo. He's joined in conversation by author Dana Spiota on Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
Why is it that it's so satisfying in a novel when something recurs, when there's a repetition that's separated by 50 pages? Why does that feel so engaging to the reader, do you think?
I think partly it's because you feel like the writer is with you. I mean, for me, the whole model of fiction is you're talking to a person and you're trying to convey respect and even affection for the stranger that you don't know. How do you do that? You do it, one, by not condescending, by over-planning, I would say.
Expecting a lot of them?
Yes, expecting a lot. Saying, you're smarter than I am, let me, you know. So I think that's a form of it. You remember that you mentioned something on page 20. You remember that they know that, and they go, hey, thank you. Thank you for giving me that credit.
It's true, and it collects meaning.
Even
if it's the same phrase,
right,
you know.
Right.
And so let's talk about the language. Each character in this... Well, first of all, I want to ask you, you do this thing where you have the character speak in the choral sections. You have the character speak, the ghosts, and then you give the attribution. And this kind of seemed like Ken Burns, you know, like he would have the person speak before he told you who is speaking, so you're kind of trying to guess from... It's like makes you pay attention to the language more in a weird way. Why did you do that?
Well, you know, at one point I had, using that old novel, I had the ghost attributions at the top.
Yeah.
And the historical ones at the bottom.
I see.
Something about that just didn't please me. Mm-hmm. You know, sometimes it just looked weird. And it also, I also thought it would do something I didn't want, which was to make too big of a deal over ghosts.
Right.
Like, one thing I didn't want to do was say, and then from the left, a ghost floated in.
Right.
You know, ew. So, not in a good way.
Well, they never use the word ghost.
Right, they never use
the word
ghost.
Because they are full of euphemism anyway. Right.
And they're not really, they're something, they're kind of ghosts, but they're
they're not.
So then, at one point,
They're sick forms.
They're sick forms, that's right. I thought it would be so cool if you just moved the ghost attributions to the bottom, then we don't make that distinction.
Right.
But this is what I love about art, is then you get into a bit of an algebra thing. Like, I knew that was going to make it a little harder for
a
first-time reader.
Right.
And you go, well, do I do it the way that feels slightly lame to me or the way that seems a little difficult but might pay off?
Right.
Then you enter into that, you know.
What I thought was so interesting, too, is that you distinguish these voices. And, for example, Bevins, we saw, and Volman, Bevins uses, because he's got the sense drunkenness, right, because he misses the world, the concreteness of the world. He's constantly, this really Victorian florid thing, but mixed with George Saunders. So there's lots of phrasal adjectives, lots of compound nouns. This is really, you really go to town. It doesn't sound anything like contemporary George.
Right.
And so he's got his own language system. And Willie is a stream of consciousness with no punctuation, the Lincoln son, and his syntax kind of broken. So did you have a book where you kept rules for each person's voice, or you heard it in your head? How did it work? There's a lot of people.
It does a lot. 166, actually.
Wow. Everybody sounds different or has different obsessions. Language is different.
This is a trick, because in my contemporary stuff, I do a lot of stories where there's two or maybe sometimes three people. And in that mode, I can make really wild contemporary voices that sound markedly different. I can only do like 2.5.
Okay.
You know? And if I have to read them out loud, I can do an old guy, a guy from Brooklyn, and a baby or something. I teach Tolstoy, not the guy, but I teach his books. That's cheap. That's like, teaching War and Peace and reading it, I was thinking, he doesn't do voice, actually. He does something else. He gets that vast cast of characters not by sound but by something else. I don't know. I mean, like maybe a lot of times with habits, a person has a certain habit of thought. So I thought if we're going to have a big chorus of ghosts, they're not going to be there's some equation. They can't be that much different from another if you're going to make a lot of them.
Okay.
So what I found myself doing was even like counting ampersands in a line that were allowed. Volman always calls Willie the lad, which is a tiny thing. But it's kind of like almost, I had a thought of having a room or an elevator that you're going to put 80 people in. You kind of place them one at a time and you just move them a little bit apart so they're a little bit different.
Right.
Kind of a big sleight of hand to make it sound like there was a lot of different voices, just with little tricks.
But it's also tricky because some of them are, it's so complex because some of them are from the 1860s, but some of them are from much earlier.
Right.
So you had to kind of import, like the crazy slave owner, he's from an earlier time, and he has his own weird diction, right?
Yeah. One of the tricks is that instead of diction, it's kind of weird. You see them on the page, and it's kind of like the way they would have written in life.
I see.
Which gives you a lot. So he uses those weird capitalizations.
Yes, the weird capitalizations, so and the ampersands are used. And then, of course, each ghost has, and this is kind of getting into the more metaphysical questions in the Bardo, or whatever they are, these sick forms, they have their, whatever troubled them in life troubles them times 100 in this middle ground that they're in, the stuck place. They're stuck somewhere. So that is another thing that distinguishes them. So let's talk about that. They for example, the woman she sort of cares only about money. She's sort of counting for all time until she moves to the next place. So it seems to me this book is saying that they need to face who they are rather than overcome that thing. Is that?
I think so. The Bardo in the title, I don't use the Bardo correctly in terms of Tibetan.
Right.
But my thought, what I do use is in some of those traditions, they talk about the fact that whatever happens to you after you die probably isn't that much different from what's happening to you right now.
Right.
Which is terrifying.
So we're making our own.
Yeah. You make your own. So that, but one of the things says, if your mind right now is an incredibly strong horse, it's got the tether of your body to slow it down a little bit. And as neurotic as we get and fearful, it's nothing compared to what happens after death when that tether gets caught and your mind gets writ large. So that's one of the ideas I was kind of using. So that's a, scary idea. And it also means that whatever mythology you live by is the one you'll likely see. So if you're a Catholic, you see that.
Right.
If you're a Buddhist, if you're a, pro wrestling fan, but that was one of the jokes,
So there's a scene where angel forms come marching through and try to persuade everybody to move to the next space, to not like clutter up the Bardo, and they manifest as different for each person, or depending on what heaven would be to them or what an appealing afterlife would be. So when you're writing about this, are you thinking about these metaphysical questions yourself? Are you thinking about the afterlife and you're writing to find out? Or is it just really the demands of the book and what works in terms of the drama and the narrative?
Yeah, I think it's the latter thing, which then will result.
Reveal in, anyway.
But if I try to think of it in advance, it just flattens out. So my thing is always to be very attentive just to the physical reality, mostly the language. And in this book especially, I spent a lot of time on, the form is really weird. It looks like a play. There's a lot of white space. So I got to be really picky about the way that looked and felt, the pace and the way you where you end a section.
So the chapter breaks are unusual.
Yeah, yeah.
And there's a lot of them.
There's a lot of them. And some of them are just too two-line
chapters.
Yeah. I kind of felt like that's where you look on that level. You look at you're doing sound and all that, and then the meaning is over here, much smarter than I am.
Right.
And it slowly will rise up if I pay attention to something
else.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
You were also thinking about sort of white space and what it looked like.
Yeah, in that kind
like
of naughty way. Like
about the sculptural quality of prose on the page.
Yeah.
You know,
that
you want to sort of it to look in a certain way.
You can get incredibly picky if you give yourself 4 years, you know, like that semicolon, it makes me sick, you know. You kind of. But it was, and also, you know, part of it, I had never written a novel before. And as we talked about earlier, it's a scary thing with stories. They go out one at a time and they get quasi vetted, you know.
Right.
This is just so. I remember thinking somebody's going to make fun of me for using so much white space. You know, that somebody's going to. Yeah, but I think that was part of the fun, was to get so into that weird little world that I had strong opinions about every little aspect of.
Yeah. So tell me about that experience, because obviously writing a collection. How many stories were in 10th of December?
I think I don't know nine.
Nine.
Nine. Yeah.
So obviously that takes 4 years too.
Yeah.
But being inside one thing for 4 years, how is that different in your experience of being a writer? I mean, don't you think did it make you crazier?
Well, I had some counsel from you on that, because you were telling me at one point the way that these, you know, I don't know if to use this exact metaphor, but if you think of a story as throwing up some bowling pins, you know,
right,
there they go. They stay up there for a while, and then what would be cool is if you could catch them, you know, maybe do one behind your back and, you know, that. And so I think the difference was the bowling pins stayed up a lot longer. And the other thing that I didn't realize would be so much fun is that some of them came down in a really unexpected way. There were dividends at the end of the book that I honestly didn't see coming. Or there were times where there were problems that I knew were in the book that I hoped would get solved. And the book was like, don't worry, I got this. And it just suddenly, just in trying to figure out section orders and stuff, boom, they just kind of came, you know. So one example was I had, one of the built-in problems with the book like this is you got ghosts and you got the living. And about 2 years in, I went, wow, that's going to be a sucky book if they don't have anything to do with each other.
Right.
You know,
right.
You could parrots and cars.
Right.
You know, whatever.
Right.
You so then you're kind of looking at it like, hey, book, you know, and the book's looking back like, yeah, we know. And it does that in the form of the characters. Like the characters start to fret about that. Like the dead people, and I found it actually really touching. They were like, do we matter? You know.
Right.
Are we actually so low on the food chain that we can't affect anything anymore? Oh, that's sad for us, you know. And but I didn't actually know if they could or not. And so the book sort of became about that, you know, could those lines cross or not? And then in the end, they did, but in a way that I didn't see coming, you know. So I'm sure you've had that. I mean, we talked about that. It's such a rich thing.
Yeah, and that is, I mean, that's when everything's working. And like you say, you're so caught up in the form of it that these sort of bigger thematic things just happen.
Yeah,
these connections become. And so when you get to, there's some, you make Lincoln, for example, in that section, and then later, he makes the case, or the book makes the case for the war, essentially, for prosecuting the war to its end. And and there's another section where some characters, some little devils, are kind of arguing that there is no morality because they're sort of destined to be this way. They are what they are, and so they did what they did.
Right.
And so you are very interested in moral questions in your short stories and here, and putting your characters in a position where they have to make these deep moral choices.
Yeah.
And I feel that way too. I'm very interested in that as well. And you don't. And it's almost like you want to make the best case for both sides. So I feel like those devils are there to kind of make some other counter, you know, and then there's Lincoln making his decision. Did you think about, I mean, do you agree with Lincoln?
I of course. No. You know what was funny?
I was wondering, when I was reading it, I was like, I don't know.
I don't know either. You know what happened with that was there's a scene where he's leaving the graveyard, and it's kind of his big goodbye scene. You know? And I had had sort of solved the problem of the, it turns out in the world that the spirits actually can affect him, but in a very, almost like a flu, you know?
Right.
They're in there, and they have been in passing through him all night with their sad stories, because they're all sad because they're all stuck.
Right.
And he is made incrementally more sadder by that, which then he starts to think, you know, this life is all about, all of us are in such pain. Even if we're happy, we're in sorrow at some
suffering.
Level, or it's coming soon, suffering. And I love that, because that's what I think, it turns
out.
You know?
Right.
And
Right.
And then that's where
very
that,
beautiful.
That's where that historical mold comes in, because the honest part of me said, yeah, that's a nice thought, but also he's going to go out and kill about 200,000 people this
year.
You know?
Right.
Well, that kind of sucked. You know, like, oh, no, that undercuts his speech. But artistically, you go, ooh, that undercuts his speech.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So then you
it
have,
makes it complicated.
Yeah, you have somebody having a very earnest realization and then going, oops, you know, which, who hasn't done that? So, but that was one of those found things where I just, it was just reading it the next day and going, yeah, that's nice, but, well, Shiloh is in 2 months.
Right.
You know?
It's a problem.
Then, so, so the book gives you that. But I love that in Chekhov, you know, I teach a story called Gooseberries, and in there there's this beautiful part where a guy makes this gorgeous speech about how happiness is corrupt. We shouldn't be happy. In a world full of suffering, happiness is wrong. Anybody who reads it goes, that is beautiful. It sounds like Chekhov speaking directly to us. Then a couple pages later, that guy who made the speech is sharing a room with his friend, and he goes, he says, oh, Lord, help us, and pulls a sheet over his head. And he leaves his filthy pipe right on the table and keeps his friend awake with this. And it's this beautiful thing where he is right and he's a blowhard. He's totally morally correct and he's thoughtless, you know.
Yeah.
And Chekhov being Chekhov just goes, yep, you know.
Yeah. And this is the great thing that fiction can do, it just has to frame it in an honest way, and that is complicated. And you don't have to resolve it, and you don't have to reduce it to absolutes.
That's right.
You know, it's not reducing. It's complicating because you're in seeking the truth.
Yeah.
Which brings me to the president. So let's talk about Donald Trump for a second. You wrote this wonderful article, award-winning article for The New Yorker about the Trump supporters.
Yeah.
And that was in July. And since that time, Trump became the president.
What? Wait, no, go back.
I'm sorry to tell you this, George.
So
when you were writing the article, you didn't say, I think these guys might win, you know.
No.
But did you think that they would win at that time? And what would you, is there anything you would add or change to what you wrote then?
I didn't think they would win, but I noticed I came home panicked a little bit. I became really obsessive about checking the news, and I was always finding those articles that would reassure me that they wouldn't win. And what I saw, in retrospect now, you know, there was incredible energy at the rallies. And what really threw me off was I went out there thinking I'd do a quick one rally thing, cherry pick a few excessive right-wing quotes worked on. The people were so friendly. You know, I would say I'm a reporter, I'm a liberal, I'm a little left of Gandhi. You know, and they were so happy to be asked, actually, so friendly. And we had lots of nice conversations. And there were violence things that I didn't, at the first rally, I didn't see it, but I was within a couple hundred feet of it. So it wasn't like it was all, you know, the Brady Bunch. But it was, as these nonfiction pieces, you hope they are, it destabilized my view when I went out there. I thought it was going to be this, and it was something totally different.
Right.
So that confused me that so many people who were not lunatic fringe were very enthusiastic. I should have noticed that, actually. That was the one thing. And then the other thing, this was back in those ancient days of April. Remember that? Wow. And one thing I noticed was that I was really struck by the extent to which we were talking two different languages.
Yeah.
And as cordial as it was, the conceptual systems just didn't mesh. In the piece, I say it's like if you were, you know, we ride up to a castle and you only watched Monty Python and I've only watched Game of Thrones. You know.
Yeah, it's a problem.
Yeah, and at the time I kept saying, what, you know, what do you, trying to be a good reporter, what do you guys, you know, where do you get your media? And they would always say, well, not just on Fox.
Right.
But what I didn't know at the time was they were talking about Fox was sort of central.
They were talking about Breitbart.
You know? Yeah, Breitbart, right, which I didn't even know about at that time.
Right,
so, yeah.
Right. But Now we all know about it.
Yeah. So I don't think I would really change anything because my thing was I'm trying to be open and generous. And I come from, especially in my 20s, you know, I came from a very, I was doing a lot of working class jobs. And, and so I feel like the last 20 years have been a very sad story of the money going up, up, up. You know, and if you had a hillside community and all the oxygen left the middle regions and went to the peak, there would be a lot of anxiety on the hillside, you know. So I think that's what Trump exploited. And so that was a difficult reporting piece to see people, some of whom, not all of whom, had real hardships, were, in my view, badly misunderstanding the source of that.
Right.
You know, so it was really, still, I think it's so confusing even now.
It is really confusing. Yeah. You say this interesting thing in it. You say that from the beginning, America has been of two minds about the other capitalized. One mind says, be suspicious of it, dominate it, deport it, exploit it, enslave it, kill it as needed. The other mind denies that there can be any such thing as the other in the face of the claim that all are created equal. So, you know, in Lincoln and the Bardo, we get this moment of crisis over this very flawed American, you know, flawed from the beginning with slavery, the American experiment, and Lincoln is there trying to salvage this thing and kind of, you know, go to this this version of the other where all are created equal. So is this like, this is the essential American problem? We just can't seem to get over this? I mean, is this
how
are we here?
When I got out, when this book was finished before the Trump thing started, so I had one feeling was, wow, this country is really got a beautiful aspiration that it's never quite done, but we could. You know,
right.
the country kind of came out of amber for me, like, wow, this is incredible what we're doing here. Let's go ahead and actually do it.
Right.
And I was thinking, at that time, Black Lives Matter was in the news a lot.
Right.
And I thought, man, we really, as you said, the original sin was slavery. So I think that's...
And also the... taking all the Indians' land.
That was the other original sin. We have a few.
American
There's
land,
a few
yeah.
original
a
sins.
A few original
yeah.
sins. Yeah.
yeah, but I was really inspired with the thought that it's a work in progress and so on.
Yeah.
So this was a complicated thing to have that nice rosy idea of things go to a Bernie Sanders rally and go, yeah, that's what I'm talking about. He got it. And
right.
he gave a speech in Flagstaff when I was covering this piece that was so on it. I mean, often you hear a political speech and you're like, yeah. Yeah, that's kind of, you know, that's not bad, you know. But this was an hour and 20 minutes of just like, holy crap, you know, he's saying exactly what I think, you know. So that was a
right.
high watermark, and then it's hard to believe how far we've come.
This is Bina, KALW series featuring artists and thinkers who've spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Today's program features writer George Saunders, whose new novel is Lincoln in the Bardo. He's joined in conversation by author Dana Spiota. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
Well, this book feels to me that the right counter to, I mean, all of us in such despair. And this book kind of restores the possibility of America in my mind to remind me that there is that you know, there was one time a good president.
Yeah, remember that guy, that one guy. You know what I actually found?
A thoughtful, complicated man.
Yeah. The one thing that I took away from this, you know, you're in that artistic space for 4 years. You know, when you're using parts of your mind that are intuitive and kind of speculative, and you have to be pretty comfortable with ambiguity. And I was really amazed by how I'm always amazed when writing how capacious that part of your mind is. The part that doesn't actually have to articulate anything. It kind of works back here, and it manifests itself in those small decisions. But to be in that mindset for 4 years was so rich and wonderful.
Right.
Then coming out of that and going on the campaign trail, and then kind of you should immerse yourself in that world. So I'm watching Twitter, and I'm on Facebook, and I'm reading, watching
CNN. I'm doing that, and I'm not writing anything.
Well, I still am, too. But to do that and notice that it's a different mind, you know, isn't it? There's two different headspaces. The first one is big, and it's loving, and it's generous,
mm-hmm.
and it doesn't necessarily have to know for sure. The second one, as I saw it in me, snarky, a little aggressive, a little sharp, you know, happy to, like, knock somebody in the head and then go, hey, done.
Yeah, like we're like Twitter trolls
yeah,
or something. Yeah.
Yeah. So mm-hmm. so that's okay. I mean, there's lots of different modes. But when I think about the way I feel in that second mode, multiply times the hundreds of thousands of interactions that we all have in that mode,
yeah.
I think that's going to be the real story 20 years from now. The way that the collective consciousness has changed through these surficial, snarky things.
Yeah, and I think the novel is a place that requires a sort of deep, long look at something.
Yeah.
And it really is countercultural right now because most of our interactions are so horizontal and shallow because of the technology. So, yeah, I mean, we all need to read books and get away
from
them.
Just this one.
Just Lincoln and the Bardo.
Read it over and over.
Over and over again.
Good audience.
But don't read the same copy.
Yeah.
But I will say this. The one thing, I'm pretty quasi-discouraged, but I also think those of us who are here, who would care enough about art and reading, there's a moment for us to be, to sort of stand up again and say, part of the reason we might be in this situation is because we've marginalized art culturally all these years. You know, don't you have that feeling like, I'm an artist. You go to a family party, what do? I write books. Yeah, sorry, you know. But I think if you spend your cultural capital on modes of communication that don't use all of your resources, don't be surprised if you look up and your public discourse is doing what it's doing right now.
Right.
And don't be surprised if somebody can get up there and in the most Orwellian terms say these crazy-ass things and then seem to believe that if they just say it 3, the magic number,
right. It
makes it true.
It's true.
You know. So I think we should all sort of sharpen our linguistic knives and remind ourselves in the culture that the power and language are the same thing, and we can actually discern lies from truth and good intentions from cruelty and so on.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Great. Yeah. So, audience questions.
Hi. Do you have a routine or habits that keep you or give you access to the compassionate, capacious part of you?
No, I don't. I just talk about it a lot. That's kind of my... I think that's probably... I'm a sort of an amateur Buddhist, you know, and I think for me that's been... When I've been able to actually do it, it's been really, really helpful. But I think, in a way, you know, it's kind of like for me, this idea of the sacred is just to remind yourself that what you're feeling at any given moment isn't the sum total of what could be felt, right? So if you have, you know, most days you're kind of at 2.6 on the awareness scale, and then maybe you go into a church and you get up to 8, then the spiritual practice would be remembering that 8 exists, really, you know. I think that's kind of, you know, I don't know. Pray? I don't know.
So, George, I apologize if this is redundant to a lot of the questions you probably answer about this current book, but we're talking about how important a novel is for empathy, and especially in this type of time, how we consume our media and our short-term attention spans. And so before you wrote this novel, many of your books were able to convey that empathy in encapsulated ways. I mean, you read a short story of yours, and it just hits you really hard, both with the humor and the empathy. So after this, in this novel, which is fantastic, with the need for more fiction and that conveying that empathy, will you go back to short stories? Will you just continue on in the novelization? Or how'd you like the exercise of doing it in this long form versus your previous?
I really loved it. I think I'll go back to stories because for me, the operating premise with this book was don't be a novel unless you have to.
Right.
You know, so I think I'll just go right back to short stories.
But you might find something else that has to be a novel.
When I was younger, I wrote this book. My wife and I were very young and very broke, and I went to a wedding in Mexico, and I came back and I said, honey, you are sitting on a gold mine. This novel, this Mexico novel, ho, 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 you know. And so I wrote it, you know, and it ended up being 700 pages, and just to give you an idea of its literary quality, it was called La Boda de Eduardo, which I think means like Ed's wedding, you know, something like that. So I remember I wrote it, and I really loved it. You know, it was very Joycean, and not no irony. It was really Joycean. No verbs, baby. That's so 1970s. And so then I gave it to my wife, and I did that writerly thing where you say, just if you want to look at it, you know, just no rush, whenever you get to it. And I, like, camped out outside the room and peeked in. And I think she got to maybe page 4.
Oh,
and,
wow.
And no, really, and I looked in, and she just had her head in her hands like this, because she knew what that had cost us as a family.
Oh.
You know? So that really, I mean, I joke about it now, but it was a burn, you know.
Really?
And I'm never going to waste time that way again. So even now, I'm like, don't.
Well, that is the thing about a novel is you can It takes a lot of time, and it sucks.
Do you have sucky novels at home?
We've had this conversation.
I know. That's why I'm luring you out.
Next question.
I asked her this in New York. What was your big failed novel? She goes, my first one was my first book, and I told you
I had a lot of bad short stories. Yeah. Okay.
So, you know, given that it's about Lincoln and there's this huge topic of slavery, you know, I wonder if there are characters, especially, you know, slave characters, black characters, and I wonder, as a writer, how do you think about writing for characters that are both, you know, from voices that tend to get underrepresented and are very different from your voice or very different from your personal experience?
Right. Thank you. There are slave characters in the book, and it was a little bit one of these things where there's a technical issue, because my understanding was that at Oak Hill Cemetery at that time there were no people of color could be buried there, or Jews. I thought, okay, that's good. I don't have to go into slavery. I don't have to cover it. And then you think you can't, you know, as you're saying, you can't write a book about Lincoln. So then I just sort of said, let me just use the same lens for every person in the book. And for me, that always means be loving towards a person, which technically means pay close attention and use the same sort of prism for everybody, you know. So then it was just, and the way I tend to do that is I just try to find the corollary inside myself. So if I'm, in this case, one of the first slave characters I wrote was a guy who, his name is Elson Farrell, and I just thought, what would I have been like, you know? And I think I would have been somebody who maybe thought, had the idea that if I just performed well enough, I could miss a lot of the misery. So he does that. So really, it was kind of just the assumption that in fiction, since nobody can know anybody, including I can't even know myself, then if you look at the person with love and with focus and with some sense of honoring them, then maybe it would play out all right, you know.
I mean, one of the things in the book that's so beautiful is that the people actually can climb into somebody else. Sort of the dream of fiction is manifest in the book, and they have this incredible connection to that other person once they've been inside them, and then they feel so alone when they come out. And it's almost that way when you're, you know, the kind of empathy the dream of empathy that you get from fiction, right? From writing fiction and from reading fiction. And it's so beautifully manifested in that gesture when they kind of overlap.
Yeah, kind of the idea that if you just tried hard enough, you might be able to, you know,
be in someone else's shoes, right?
So contrary to what you said about sharpness and snarkiness, I experienced your piece last year on Trump supporters as a really remarkable extension of that generosity which you associate with fiction to these people. And so I'm a high school student in San Francisco, and I know very few Trump supporters. I haven't spoken with any at length about their views. And I see this man in the White House as really vicious and has a real recklessness with language that I have never seen before. So I'm wondering, can you still find that generosity given the real effects his actions have had on people just in these last few weeks?
Yeah, I think that, don't you think that's kind of the big question that everybody is mulling over? You know, those of us who last year would have made the big case for empathy and, you know, generosity of spirit, you kind of go, well, you know. I think the way I feel right now is you have to double down on that, because if in fact there's a fight of sorts to come, then I think compassion and empathy properly understood are incredible tools. They actually make you a stronger opponent of whatever you want to fight. Now, like hatred, shrillness, hyperbole, those actually are easily ignored. But so I think you can do two things at once. You can be incredibly interested in the opponent and empathetic towards her, him, and you can also be incredibly firm in your resistance. Sometimes, you know, when I, as a like a whiny liberal craphead, that's what I am, I think that empathy means or else this one, you know, like that. Yeah. So somebody, you know, drives a spike through your head, and you're like, oh, thank you for that new coat hanger, you know, like that. But I think actually there's another way, which is that actually empathy can be real active and real energized, and we could think of it as if you were playing another football team, wouldn't it be cool if you could mind meld with their coach? that would be all for the good, you know. So I'm trying to see it as not an either or, if I understand the question correctly. Yeah.
You might already be leaning towards answering this question, but I think it pertains to both of your works of fiction. And but in the context of considering morality when you're writing, I'm just interested in the relationship between the critical and the hopeful, because I think that there's a lot of that in both of your works. So,
yeah. Well, I think I guess I would say that the you can't really be hopeful until you've been critical. You know, you can't really be hopeful until you have clear sight of what the situation is. So I think that would be it. You know, first you want to say, this country sucks. Look at our ugly public places. Look at our stupid internet. Look at our ridiculous TV. You know, we all have hemorrhoids. What a bunch of losers. And then I think in fiction what you can do is you can make that statement and run around the table and make the equal and opposite one. We're so lovely. Look at this beautiful building, you know. The Golden Gate Bridge is so nice. Most of us don't have hemorrhoids, you know. And then the idea that the truth actually is, which is true, yeah. That, right. You know, I think, right, that's a
good... Well, I mean, it's like being able to live in the tension, you know, is the, instead of trying to push things into one place or another, feels the more honest position. I just saw that today, I saw the James Baldwin documentary, I'm Not Your Negro, so great. You have to all see it. And he talks about being an optimist because you have no, you know, like he's alive and he's speaking and he has to be. And there was something so inspiring about his ferocity and his anger and his hope. You know, you can have all of those things at once. In fact, they all tie together in this way. So severely critical because you have hope. Absolutely. Mm. You know, if you didn't have hope, you'd just give up. You'd have despair.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
So wonderfully, you know, we need writers. We need writers like James Baldwin and George Saunders.
And
it helps us.
Yeah.
So I'm curious to hear your reflections on, in a day and age with social media, in a day where the president has the loudest microphone, and we're trying to double down on compassion and hearing and being humble and admitting maybe we don't have all the answers and we need to be engaged in dialogue. How do you do that when I feel like sometimes we're holding flowers against bulldozers? What is the form of engagement? How do we like have that soft voice heard in the context of that cacophony of media?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think maybe one of the things is to reconceptualize it as not a soft voice at all. You know, it's a very fierce voice. We are citizens as well, you know, every bit as much. So I think for me, now I'm naturally a soft kind of, like I don't really like fighting and so on, but I think everybody should fight in their mode. You know, if you're a fighter, then fight. If you're a screamer, then scream. I think, though, that, you know, the idea that empathy or whatever, this suite of mushy things, you know, kindness, empathy, that the idea that those are all soft, I think, is not true, you know. If somebody's really full of shit and is doing things at a distance that are causing a lovely Mexican family great heartbreak, it is not unempathetic to wake that person up. The person doing the cruelty, to wake them up by any means necessary within a peaceful range. I think actually that's the most compassionate thing you could do. If the baby's crawling towards a light socket and you go, I love you so much, that might not help. But if you grab it by the diaper, boom, then you might, you know. So I think to reconceptualize these things as not actually soft or ineffectual virtues, but they could be really muscular, you know, why not? Thank you. Yeah. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you.
Bina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and KALW. For more information about programs at the JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. Today's guest was writer George Saunders, whose new novel is Lincoln in the Bardo. He was joined in conversation by author Dana Spioda. The recording engineers at the JCCSF are Ben Bernardi, Brandon Battaglia, Dan Folds, Alex Espalay, Maya Finley, and Jake Gukowski. David Kwan edits and produces the program, and Matt Martin is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Rasha Neem Trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. Bina is available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. I'm Jordan Abel. Thanks for listening.